Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And as promised, Dr. Andrew Willard-Jones, our guest this hour, a brand new book called The Church Against the State on Subsidiarity and Sovereignty. And, you know, we don't, we try very hard not to talk about politics. We don't do economics on this show. We talk about the faith and we try to share the faith. And so let's break all those rules this hour. Let's talk about politics and economics and all of that stuff. Dr. Andrew Willard-Jones is professor of history and political theory at the College of St. Joseph the Worker in Steubenville, Ohio. First of all, welcome, thank you, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you here with us. I've been enjoying reading the book, but also I have your way of understanding some ideas that I thought I was familiar with was challenging to me, and the idea of subsidiarity in particular. In some cases I felt it was quite exhilarating what you were describing when you talked about subsidiarity. And so maybe you could start there with us. I mean, you put it right in the subhead of the book on subsidiarity and sovereignty. So what is subsidiarity?
Yeah, great. The easiest way to describe it might be the way that it most typically is, which is actually kind of inadequate, but it's an okay place to begin.
Okay.
So typically people will define subsidiarity as the principle, sort of governing principle that problems should be solved at the smallest level possible, so that interventions from above shouldn't occur unless the smaller levels of social order are somehow failing or incapable. All right, and that's an okay way of describing it, but it's negative, right? And a better way is a positive description of it, which is something like there are true human goods that are realizable or that are capable of being had, capable of being enjoyed, only at different levels of social order. So think the family, the community, the parish level, the town level, the level of a state, higher than that. That there's different levels of social order, and that there are goods, real human goods that contribute to human flourishing, that are constituted and enjoyed at those levels. And therefore, any sort of disruption of the smaller levels, which have less power than those which are bigger and have more power, is an injustice against them.
Yeah.
But even beyond that, that the higher levels of order are their function or the reason they exist is to enrich the lower levels of order, to elevate the lower levels of order into a greater share of human flourishing or a greater participation in the good as a whole.
Yeah, I have to, I may not use the example as I won't use it as well as you use it in the book. So if correcting me is part of your answer, that's perfectly fine. But an image that I found just so beautiful in this book is the image of the family welcoming a baby, and what you were able to do is show that the family welcoming the baby is not just a matter of the family giving the baby all the things it needs to welcome the child. It's also a matter of the family going out to meet the child so that the family itself is reconstituted or reinvented by the presence of the baby. And this, to me, is such a beautiful dynamic image of subsidiarity in that the larger has to go out to meet the smaller. It can't just say, I'm the context in which you exist. You're not the matter that makes me exist.
That's right. Yeah. So that is, I find often that the family is the place to go because it's the experience that most of us have. Yeah. Right? And so there's some purchase there in our daily life.
Right.
And so that example where that the if you didn't have a principle of subsidiarity, then maybe you would think something like the baby is born and then the baby is just conformed to the family. So the baby is just integrated into the family, elevated, or just sort of forced to become whatever the family is.
Yeah.
But rather, like you described, it's actually not a process of incorporation, but concorporation, which is just a fancy way of saying that they're growing together, right? That the family is actually being modified in the direction of the child, as the child is modified in the direction of the family. And so what emerges is a new thing that is now a family that intrinsically includes that child. And that is the reason why the family is the child's home, right? Like the family is the place where the child belongs as himself. And it's also the reason why the family then has come to become the place or become an association that requires that child to be itself. So if, for example, if a child is lost, the family is wounded to its core, right? It's not just one of the individuals is gone, but we have 10 others. Do you see what I
mean? Yes, right, right, because, right. Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Those individuals are now their uniqueness, their personhood, and the cultivation of that personhood. So they're good. Those persons is now what constitutes the common good of the whole. So that same dynamic is applicable at bigger levels of order, larger levels of order, so that the community is like the family, like the family is to the child, the community is to the family.
Yeah.
Right. So now the community comes to the family as much as the family goes to the community, and the family is integrated into that larger life, which now has goods that the larger life makes available to the family. Right. But the family doesn't have to give up its identity or its uniqueness or its character in order to do that, because in a proper just order, the community becomes the home for the family, just like the way the family becomes the home for the child.
But then there could be communities of communities, like, say, a parish or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to me that part of what you're saying in this book, by the way, you should get it, this wonderful new book, The Church Against the State on Subsidiarity and Sovereignty, the new book by Andrew Willard Jones. It does seem to me that part of what you're saying is that we have suffered a loss of like this image that you have rooted in the family. And in this going out to meet each other, it seems like there's something about the whatever period we're in now, and you fuss a little bit over what we should call this period, but whatever it's called, whatever this is, this thing we're living in, it's much more individualized, separated, and it doesn't have all those rich layers that the good, healthy society would have.
Yeah, that's right. So, and this is a problem that has been recognized since the beginning of Western political thought. So Aristotle,
really?
Plato know that the centralization of power. So if you're going to amass power into one big homogenous centralized thing, if that's what you want, then a prerequisite is reducing the significance of all the intermediary levels of order. So what you want is a sea in the ideal, if you're a tyrant, is what you want is a sea of individuals who have virtually as little association with each other as possible. And then you can, and because that then renders them available to be for their lives to be completely structured and ordered by the big centralized thing. Right? So there's the centralization of power is always, it always involves both the rejection of any universal power, so anything bigger than the state or whatever it is that is trying to centralize power, like the church or something like that, and the rejection of the legitimacy of any power within smaller structures of order and the attempt to eliminate that. So we see you can see this very clearly with a sort of war against the church or war against family structures is one of the most obvious ones for us. But one of the reasons why it's the most obvious for us is because our society has already eliminated any thick communities, the family's like the last holdout, is the reason why we see it under attack, right? But you know, earlier in the modern period, the smaller communities, the village communities, the guilds, the clans, these were under attack, and they got liquidated as the states are built, and now the family is the last holdout, and maybe quite possibly the institution, the social institution that has the most resistance built into it, and so the hardest one to beat.
But
it might just outlast the state.
But the last one standing so far is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
It's obvious when you write that you delight in thinking about these things. There's obvious joy in the way that you write about them. And that's something I really appreciated in this book, The Church Against the State. I have to take a break, but before I take the break, and I'll give out the number again, if you'd like to talk with Dr. Andrew Willard Jones about The Church Against the State on subsidiarity and sovereignty, the number is 888-318-7884. If I asked you this question in class, I'm sitting in your class and I asked you this question, I'm wondering how you would answer it. Is the problem of government or of governance in general primarily a problem of organization or of formation? Do we need better organizations? Do we need to organize ourselves better, or do we need to be better formed as a people? Which thing matters more?
That's such an interesting question. That goes to the very heart of political theory. Okay, so let me try to answer it by saying both. Yes.
Okay.
One of the key insights of Western thought, social thought, is that the condition of the soul and the structure of the society are bound up together. All right, this goes all the way back to Plato's Republic, that a just society must be made up of just people. All right, so an increasingly unjust society is made up of increasingly unjust people. So, and Plato goes into great detail explaining how this works. So an oligarchic society, which is one of the corrupt societies, is a society that only holds together to the extent that the people have become greedy. All right, and then once they've, so their condition of their soul, they're after money, they will now build the structures necessary to maximize their gain, all right, to maximize their ability to gain.
Sounds kind of familiar.
Society. But there's this feedback loop to it, because once those structures are built, they then discipline and form the society into that virtue or vice in this case, right? So you have the relationship that of the condition of the soul and the structure of society are not temporally related, like one is prior to the other, or one's first, one's second. It's that they're two aspects of one thing. All right. A way to think about this might be something like an oligarchy. So if you're trying to amass power and you're building a structure, say, where the structure of society is such that you want people to serve you by paying them money, all right, and you're going to build a structure that's based on that, on payouts. Well, that only creates power for you if the people care about money. Right? So as soon as they don't, it doesn't work anymore.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Do you see what I'm saying? So if you change the structure, but the people aren't different, well, is it what's the new structure going to be? I mean, if the new structure is going to have power, if it's going to work, then it has to somehow match up with the condition of soul of the people. All right, and that creates a problem, because like you're saying, is like, well, if you're going to reform a society, how do you do it? And it's very detailed, it's very delicate, and it has to be a sort of dance between conversion of soul and restructuring of law, right? Because the law has an effect on the soul, but it's not the reason the soul is the way it is, though nevertheless, the discipline of law obviously affects condition of soul, right? And so you have this back and forth dance, and that's really the content of what Aristotle or the tradition will refer to as like statesmanship, like the idea that you prudentially have to navigate this, which is not foreign to us because it's like what a father has to do with his children, right? That you're navigating the difference between discipline and praise, between teaching and laying down the law. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's this dance there.
Well, something in your book made me think to ask that question. I got to take the break, so I'll let you know on the other side what it was in your book that put me in the mind of that question. 888-318-7884 is the number. The Church Against the State on Subsidiarity and Sovereignty, the beautiful, important new book by Dr. Andrew Willard Jones. We'll be right back with the author right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Wings is a weekly newsletter that's packed with program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at EWTN. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Dr. Andrew Willard Jones has a new book out called The Church Against the State. And there are lots of books in this area of conversation that Catholics are having with the world and with each other about government, about which types of government are consistent with the Christian faith. Are there types of government that are maybe not proposed by the Christian faith, but are consistent in such a way that you would even say they would proceed from a Christian populace? Are there or not? And this is a wonderful discussion. I think this is an important book in that discussion because it's not like any of the other books that you're going to read on it. It's really an original work of thinking. And I must say, and this is what I was trying to get at in the beginning, talking about subsidiarity right away, is even in the early chapters of the book, I felt I'm thinking about subsidiarity in ways I have not thought about it before, in ways that are much richer than I had thought about it before. And I think you will find the same thing. So if you've been participating in that conversation, you know, the conversation has probably been going on since the early 2000s, certainly in the publication of the book, Why Liberalism Failed. This has been, would you agree that that was kind of a seminal work that got this conversation?
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And broke it into the mainstream.
And your book is in that conversation.
Yes.
I strongly believe in a new way. This is a very serious contribution to that conversation. Check it out, The Church Against the State, Andrew Willard Jones, the author. But here's why I asked you that question about organization formation. You said a funny thing near the beginning of the book that you thought of the book as a defense of America. You said, why should I be defending America, basically? But it seems to me the American story is we are great because of these structures that we've created, the constitutional order that we've created, the federalism, all that. But that is completely wrong, that is not why we are great. We are great because of the culture that made those things, and that those things have in many ways done a wonderful job of allowing that culture to flourish. But it's our formation as a culture that made us great. It's not those structures that we invented and we think are the thing that made us great.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can think about that. Well, Americans are funny in that regard, right? Because we're kind of we're not aware of our own virtues in a lot of ways. I don't know. Yeah. Like we think the reason why we think it's because we like hit it on this great constitutional structure or something, and boy, are we lucky. But it's like, no, actually, the reason why that was a form that matched up with who the Americans were was because the Americans – it wasn't because Americans were largely self-governing people. So because that's the way we in fact are, which is another way of saying virtuous, right? Because that's the way we in fact are, then we become available. for that sort of a constitutional order.
Yes.
Do you see what
I do. I do.
Possible for us. If we're decadent, if we're greedy, if we're self-interested, if we're not self-governing but are grasping after private gain, personal gain as much as we can, personal power, whatever, well, then we're not the type that's available for a decentralized order based on some kind of subsidiarity. But then we become a people that not only sort of it's inevitable that we become a sort of centralized sovereign entity, because if everybody's competing for power, somebody's going to win.
Right? Yeah.
The force that wins becomes the force that's in power. Everybody else has to either fight it or conform to it. Inevitably, that results in the majority conforming to it, and you get a centralized power with a big homogenous conforming population. And that's sort of the way all tyrannical societies in the history of the world have gone.
Yeah.
Right. So, and what counters that is, like you were saying, is that populations. Let me try to put it this way. It's not merely some sort of moralizing idea about virtue or something. That's true, that virtue is essential. But one of the reasons why is because virtuous people are virtuous. The context for virtue is friendships. So virtuous people are formed into virtue in their interactions with other people,
yes,
right? So what we were talking about with the family. And those constellations of friendships, those groupings of people that are forming each other into virtue are strong, right? Because this is something that Aristotle will say almost in passing. He'll say, the reason why tyrants don't like friendships, the reason why they want to eliminate friendships as much as possible, is because friends won't betray each other.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, but it goes,
right,
but it's very
right.
simple. But it's even beyond that people who are embedded in homes that involve other people. I don't just mean like the house. I mean the house, the home, the family, the community, the parish, the city, where they are friend, where those groupings are based upon the love and loyalty that constitutes friendships. Those people who live in those worlds occupy worlds where they're not alone, they're not lonely. And that means that they're not scared, or they're way less scared. They're less anxious. Right? They're less fearful. They're less vulnerable.
Yeah.
And because human beings are social in our very natures, vulnerable, scared, anxious people are desperate. They're desperate for some power that will assuage those disorders. Right? And those become the people who are most susceptible to any sort of mass centralized power. Right? And so these groupings of friendships, which is where virtue is formed, which is where happiness is had, is also where power is diffused. Like quite literally, those things are powerful things,
yes,
right? You can only push them so far,
right?
Right?
Right.
They have
which
the
is
ability.
Why, yeah, which yeah. is why in Nicaragua, they're getting rid of the church. They're trying literally to shove nuns and priests and bishops out of
right.
the country or into prison, because the friendship that the church constitutes is mm-hmm. is powerful, and it has power that the state wants to take away.
That's right. Anywhere where there is are real embedded relationships, there is in those places basis of order, basis of peace, foundations of social life that is not given to it from above. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
there,
yes,
it's
yes,
not
yes.
it's
right.
not that your peace is structured by the police force or by the regulatory apparatus or something. Your peace emerges out of your very relationships. Well, those places then are places where there's social strength that is not dependent upon the larger institution. Well, that's a threat to the larger institution. It's the same reason why the Roman Empire went after the Christians in the early church, because they posed exactly that kind of a problem.
Is that why the book is called The Church Against the State?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So what I'm talking, and that's provocative, I know, and it kind of raises eyebrows with people, but when I'm talking about the state there, I'm not talking about government. I'm not talking about political order. I'm not talking about social structure. I'm talking about the state is a modern phenomenon, right? The state as we think of it is something that is well, it's ancient in some regards, and then not medieval, and then it kind of resurfaces in the modern period. But for our purposes, we can talk about it as a modern phenomenon. It's something that emerges in the late medieval and into the early modern period, exactly as the church as the various kingdoms of Europe try to seek independence from the universal thing, which is the church. All right, so seek a ground for their own power that's not based on them participating in a larger life of the church. So they want to get out from underneath the church, if you want to think of it that way. And then at the same time, they're eliminating diversity within their borders. So it's about eliminating... Ooh. Yeah, so the construction of the modern state has two movements to it. There's the movement of divorce from the universal and homogenization or elimination of diversity internally. Uh-huh. And those two movements are what constitute the modern nation state, the modern state.
Yeah, you could see that in Spain very clearly. I mean, if you think of the history of Spain, homogenize the state and then and centralize state power.
Right. Yeah, so that's what they want to do. That's the move of the modern period, the movement of the modern period. And that's – so when I'm saying the church against the state – that's what I'm referring to.
Okay. All right. We're going to talk more about it. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, 888-318-7884. It gets better and better the more you talk about it. What a great book, The Church Against the State on Subsidiarity and Sovereignty. Andrew Willard Jones is its author, and he is our guest. And this is your chance to talk to him, 888-318-7884.
Deepen your connection to the church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the church fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. There was Plato, there was Aristotle, and now there's Dr. Andrew Willard Jones. How's that? You ever get an introduction like that before?
No.
That's, boy. Talk about stopping the heart of a philosopher. The Church Against the State is the new book on subsidiarity and sovereignty. You're welcome to call and get involved in the conversation. You are very welcome here, 888-318-7884. You don't have to agree with anything you've heard. And if you want to take us off on one of the tangents that we've gone on, you want to go back to that, whatever you want to talk about, The Church Against the State is the book. Dr. Andrew Willard Jones is the author, and the number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. So we were talking about why the book is called The Church Against the State. And it's not about the church replacing the state. You do think the state has a role.
Yeah, well, certainly government the government does.
And I see, and government does. Right.
Yeah. So to the extent that we call that the state, we can do that, although it can be a little bit confusing.
Sure.
Right. So I think that the communities in a subsidiarity hierarchy, the communities at every level of scale have an authority that's appropriate to them.
Okay.
Right.
So what is the problem with sovereignty then? I have to admit to you, that was the hardest part of the book for me to grasp. Was I know I was completely taken in by the carrot of subsidiarity. I loved the way you wrote about it. I didn't fully understand the objection to sovereignty. Could you explain that to me?
Yeah, sovereignty is in a lot of ways the central idea of modern political theory. It emerges in the early modern period. And what it amounts to, I'm just going to try to give my short sort of polemical answer, is it amounts to taking something that's rightfully attributed only to God and bringing it down into the world and assigning it to a human construction. And that what that thing is a power or authority of which there's nothing higher, right? So that's answerable to nothing else, right?
Yeah. And
not only is there nothing higher, but in a sense, there's nothing lower, okay? So meaning that anything that operates, any power that operates below the sovereign does so through the sovereign's permission or the sovereign's commissioning of them.
Yeah.
So they're sharing in the sovereign power, which means they have no authority intrinsic to themselves, no power that emerges out of what they are, right? So that the smaller groupings might be granted some kind of authority, but they're granted it by this hegemonic thing. Go ahead.
I can see that when I think of the evil communist dictators in China.
Yeah.
But, you know, because that is, they'll tell you that's what they're doing. They're making everything the state. But how does that apply to a liberal democracy? Like, say, I don't know, the United States.
Sure. So the idea, think about it this way. So I'm glad you brought up liberalism. And by liberalism here, I'm going to try to discuss it, not meaning left liberalism, but liberalism as a this is always confusing.
Right.
Liberalism as the tradition, one branch of the Enlightenment tradition on political thought. The assumption there, let's say, is that society is made up of a vast sea of individuals who are entering into contracts with each other for mutual gain or for individual. Everyone's seeking their own advantage, and they are interacting with each other, therefore, through agreements. And the first agreement they'll make is a social contract, right? Some sort of an agreement to establish a power that's in play. But that power then think about it this way. If every human interaction, if we conceive of every human interaction as contractual, then we're necessarily assuming or imagining that there's three parties to every human interaction. There's the two people entering into the contract, and there's the third thing, which is the state, which enforces the contract.
Okay.
Right? So if to the extent that you imagine all human interaction is contractual, to that very extent, you're imagining some political centralized power penetrating into every aspect of human interpersonal relationships. Right? And okay, so why does that matter? Well, because what ends up happening in, say, a liberal society is that there's a tendency towards starting out with that intellectual presupposition and then over the course of time attempting to render it true. All right, so what I mean is you're looking at a liberal society is evaluating the society, the condition of the people, seeing places where they have interpersonal relations that don't seem to be contractual, all right? So say interpersonal relationships that are based on loyalty, on extended families, on guild structures, I don't know, whatever, something other that's not contractual,
faith.
It's not exchange. Faith, there you go, the church. And then attempting to transform it or transfer it from something like that into relationships that are based on contract. So another way of saying that would be, say, commercializing the relationship or describing it in through the means of negotiating rights rather than talking about the fulfillment of human persons in their loving obligations to each other, but talking about mutual rights and negotiation of rights. These sorts of things allow us, or the strategy there is to re-describe human interactions that are not contractual as if they are contractual, right? All right, then you set about actually rendering that so as much as you can, right? So the trajectory of the liberal societies then is towards the commercialization of ever more realms of life, the contractualization of ever more realms of life, right? Ever more contracts, which means ever more lawsuits, which means ever more, but all of that is an ever greater expansion of the central authority, the central power.
Who has to settle any dispute of a contract.
Right.
So it, always is involved.
Always is involved. So the more you can expand competition, the more you expand the state. You see, so what that means is that as people, and this is what we were talking about earlier, as people conform to that way of that mode of being, so to the extent that we in fact come to resemble the liberal theory of man, which is self-interested, a self-interested actor, to the extent that we come to actually be that way, to that extent, the power that structures those competitive relationships is sovereign. Right, it is in fact the universal power, and as so there's, you know, that means it theoretically has no limit. It theoretically structures everything. Right. Historically speaking, it's in the process of making that true as it can.
So, for example, it could just begin to redefine reality if it wanted to. It could say,
"Well, yeah,
marriage has always meant this, but now it means this." Or
absolutely,
gender has always meant this, but now it means this.
No. That's right.
Am I getting it right? I'm getting the idea.
Yeah. So once you go that far, you start getting into the final stages of this sort of a thing, right? Or the final pushes.
Yeah.
Where the final pieces of the social reality that are not created by the state are now under review.
Yeah.
You know, the
which
final
is terrifying.
Components.
Which is terrifying.
Yes.
Right. We're choosing for ourselves whether we want to follow reality or be subject to reality, or to have reality be subject to us. We're the arbiters of what's real.
I mean, the thing that's important to realize is that had you gone to a, say, medieval village and told them that their activities, their farming, their artisan activities, their creation, had you told them that that was all economically motivated by supply and demand and price mechanisms and competitive, they would have looked at you like you were crazy. And like, no, it's not. We're friends. We live here together. We are, that this is the same sort of way that when someone comes to me and tells me that my family is nothing but a social construction and that my wife and I are engaged in these mutual exchanges, blah, 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 blah. And I say, well, that's nuts. That's not what's happening. That's what people who are engaged in thick communities at other levels of scale also thought when someone came and told them this.
Dr. Andrew Willard-Jones is our guest. The Church Against the State is the book. But I want to take a call because I haven't taken any yet. You mind if we go to the phones?
No, let's do it.
Let's go to Al in Cleveland, Ohio, listening on AM 1260, The Rock in Cleveland. Al, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Dr. Willard-Jones.
Hello.
Al. Go ahead.
Okay. So I've just hopped onto the show real quick here. I'm on my way home from work. It was kind of interesting. And I'm a mailman. There's a guy I talked to on my mail route. He's a Jewish fellow. He's real nice. And he talks to me a lot about topics related to sort of subsidiarity. And one of the things he always brings up is the Declaration of Independence and how unique it is in that it brings in a relationship with the Creator. And it creates an actual covenant with the Creator. And his argument is always, I'm going to try and sum it up, is that like when you bring in the Creator through a covenant, you bring in everything connected to him. So when the Declaration of Independence declared this republic to be like a sovereign state under the Creator, like it brings the Creator, and they clearly use biblical language, so they're clearly referencing the biblical Creator of Genesis. And like that, it creates a very unique situation for our country, and I really like hearing him talk about stuff like that. I just find it really interesting. But then he goes on about stuff like how the United States right now, there's been like Supreme Court cases or something like that that have declared it like a corporate entity. So that kind of like takes away from the Declaration of Independence. And he can go on and on about all this stuff. And just, what do you think of that?
Well, thank you. thank you for the question. I will try to give a thought, maybe. Anytime, so the invoking of a creator, of God as the source, can be a crucial component is perhaps a necessary component in undoing theories of sovereignty. Because the idea would has to be something like this, there is a created order, and that order has truth content and has ethical content kind of baked into it. Right now, so there's a way that things are created to be. Now, that way they're created to be can be incredibly variable, right? Like the way in which, say, the way that the example Thomas Aquinas gives is the Ten Commandments say, honor your mother and father. Okay, that becomes a law. But the manner in which you do that is incredibly variable, right? Like one culture can honor their mother and father very differently than another culture can. But what has to happen if they're going to be under the creator is that they honor their mother and father, even though the place for human creativity and human legislation is practically infinitely variable under that umbrella, right? But what's happening there is that you're saying that the human political construction is always a participation, a mediating into the world of the divine authority, of the divine power, the divine order, and it does not find its source in the human construction. You see, so what that means is that the human power is always capable of being judged, right? Because it means that that same creating divine power that institutes the top of the subsidiarity hierarchy, say the state, what we think of as a state, it's also constituting the bottom, right? So the family itself is a product of the creator's act, as is the larger levels of community. You see what I mean? They're not receiving a kind of charter of existence from some man-made power, but are rather participating in a divine order that no man-made power creates or holds into being. And that means then that once you have that kind of a conception, then you can have both levels of hierarchy, right? You can have higher levels of authority, but at no point do those higher levels of authority escape the ability to be judged, because they themselves have a certain role to play or a certain hierarchical position where they are themselves mediating the divine law, the moral law, into the social whole. Well, that's also happening at the lower levels. You see, so the lower levels can then have a position to judge them. So an example might be, I know this may be very complicated, but an example might be, let's say we have a mayor of our city and he has a certain amount of authority, and that authority is real, and I need to obey him within the realms of that authority. But if he comes into my living room and starts disciplining my children, then I, as a father, in my own power, right? Like, not because I've been granted it by someone else, but in my own authority as my office in society, can say, hey, man, get out of my living room, right? Stop disciplining my children. That's my job. So even though he's a higher power, he doesn't have sovereignty. You see, because we're participating in some order that is greater than all of us, right? And that is somehow present in all the different places. See what I'm saying?
Al, do you see? Did that make sense to you?
Oh, yeah. I really like that last part. That was really interesting. Us fulfilling our office, our individual offices in the world. I think that's really interesting concept.
I think we're losing you just a little bit, Al, but I'm very glad you caught us on the way home. Thank you. Did you want to say something, Andrew? You look like you were about to say something. All right, I'm going to take a quick break then. We'll be right back. We'll continue with our conversation about the church against the state on subsidiarity and sovereignty, the new book from Dr. Andrew Willard Jones. And don't let me let you go without asking you about St. Joseph the Worker. I would like to know about the College of St. Joseph the Worker. We'll do that when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
This is Father Ken Briganti. Catholic Radio reaches a vast audience of people. It's an excellent tool of evangelization in the 21st century. So radio is the best way for us to get to know the Lord, and then we can love Him and serve Him and prepare ourselves in this life to be with Him for all eternity.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and His gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am just having a great time talking about this book. I had a great time reading this book. It's really something, The Church Against the State on Subsidiarity and Sovereignty. I'll tell you what, if you've ever been like, I'm not exactly sure what we mean by subsidiarity, and you kind of have a general view that that it means that the state can't parent your children. That's true, but there is a more expansive way of thinking about subsidiarity, and you can find it in this book, The Church Against the State, the new book by our guest, Dr. Andrew Willard Jones. So we talked a little about subsidiarity, a little bit about sovereignty. Is subsidiarity an entirely Catholic idea? Do you draw this from the Catholic Church, or does it have a wider provenance?
Yeah, the term itself, in the way we use it, is largely of Catholic social doctrine. Pius XI in the 1930s, I think, coined it. For public consumption, he coined it. It was right. Used in academic circles before that, but it's really a. It takes a lot of input from the tradition, deep tradition. I mean, from the Platonic and Aristotelian, Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, of an understanding of a thick hierarchical social structure, which is really an analog to the thick hierarchical cosmic structure. Right? And yes. So human beings are a microcosm and are therefore ordered, when we are ordered in justice, that common good, the form that order takes towards the common good is a form that looks sort of like the cosmic hierarchical order. And when that's really the idea, I think, of subsidiarity at the deepest levels. It's really a anthropology and a metaphysics, yeah, rather than it is an argument over policy. Yeah. It's not really a policy argument.
would you say... It doesn't seem to me that I'll put it this way. It didn't seem to me in the reading of the book that you could say, well, this clearly aligns with one of the two main political positions that the world has. I mean, actually, there's three, maybe even four big positions globally. But you have generally left against right, liberalism, conservatism. These are the general expressions. I think maybe this populism is a new thing. I'm not exactly sure, but it seems to be different from for that reason, kind of exciting and terrifying.
Then there's
just a naked statism like in Nicaragua or China or North mm-hmm. Korea. But mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me that you're saying, you know, this subsidiarity thing, if you really followed it, you'd be a conservative. Or if you really followed it, you'd be a liberal. That doesn't seem to me that you're finding that kind of a fit anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the big problem is, and like you brought up populism, so things are changing, right? So things are shifting and moving. So, but generally speaking, in the last 100 years or so, definitely through the 20th century, the two big political options in the United States anyway, yeah, the right and the left in the United States, were really, for the most part, when this is a generalization, but for the most part, were different flavors of liberalism, right? So you had kind of a right-wing liberalism, a kind of left-wing liberalism, but different flavors of that that basic ideology. And then you have in Europe and other places different flavors of socialism, right? So like communism, social democracy, different flavors of socialism, which are somewhat analogous to the way we had different flavors of liberalism. But all of those, both those options, the kind of left or the liberal option or the quasi-socialist option, are really versions of Enlightenment political theory, and versions of universal sort of rationalist political theories that deny the significance of subsidiarity or even acknowledge it as existing.
Yeah,
both sides,
right,
both of
they
those
don't.
Things do.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so when you see subsidiarity, you see that the way in which human flourishing is embedded in these real communities, then where you find maybe in the modern world some affinity is in some of the populist stuff. Maybe you get hints of it in some of the nationalist writings that have been written. But most of the time, those things, because they're not Christian, take that idea of some sort of solidarity or fraternity between men and then ideologize it, and you end up with, you know, right-wing totalitarianism or whatever.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and so,
you do.
And that's just a different sort of error, right? So one way of thinking about it might be that, I mean, you think about the French Revolution and the slogan of the French Revolution, the liberty fraternity or liberty equality fraternity. And if you think, you know, liberty is sort of that liberalism move and equality, that kind of socialist move, and then fraternity turns into the nationalist and in its most extreme form, fascist move. And what is missing, this is typical of all heresy, right, is that you take one component of the truth or one piece and absolutize it at the expense of the others.
Yep.
And so most of the modern ideologies, really those three big ones, are examples of that. And that's one of the reasons why Catholic social teaching seems confusing to people, is because they're raised up in those ideological systems, and then they see Catholic social teaching and it feels like a strange hodgepodge.
It does.
You know, like we took a little bit of this and we took a little bit of that and we took a little bit of this. But that's actually the total opposite of what's going on. What's actually going on is that the ideologies have ripped apart Christian teaching.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So they've taken individual liberty at the expense of equality and fraternity. They've taken equality at the expense of liberty and fraternity, you know,
right.
And they've maximized those and created the ideologies.
Yeah.
But they're the ones who are derivative from us, not the other way around.
I love it. I love that analysis. It's brilliant and fantastic, and thank you for it. Again, The Church Against the State is the name of the book. But okay, so that is description. What is the prescription?
Yeah, that is always the hardest questions, especially for a historian. And normally, historians try to dodge it by saying that. But I'm going to try to give it an answer. The beauty is of subsidiarity, when you come to understand it, is that you come to understand that human happiness, which is the objective here, human happiness does not depend on the proper order of the biggest and strongest things, right? The biggest and strongest things can aid human happiness, and they ought to, contribute to it. But where we find it most immediately is in our families and in our friendships, right? So we build structures of peace, communities of peace, communities of virtue, communities of helping each other, of self-government. And that's where human flourishing is the most intense. And larger things, and not only is that where it's most intense, but as we build those things, we become powerful and not easy to boss around and not susceptible to threats.
We're protected, not, you know, in other words. By
we're
those,
protected.
By those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So what I, the beauty of it is that you don't have to win the biggest fight to win the small fights, right? The small fights are within your power, like the power we have. I have, you have, we all have. We have power. We're not helpless. And if we order those places that we control towards justice, that is the means by which the whole thing becomes available to be ordered to justice. Right? That's the only way
wow.
it'll happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So it's not just not hopeless. It's you know, we have work to do. We can do it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a mission. It's not just hope. It's do this. Yeah, exactly. I'm so glad we got to talk about The Church Against the State on Subsidiarity and Sovereignty, the new book from Andrew Willard Jones. It really is an important book, and I hope many, many people will read it. I've only left you about 30 seconds to tell me about St. Joseph the Worker College.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So it's a new college in Steubenville. It's different because what it is a liberal arts college where we learn about politics, economics, theology, philosophy, and then at the same time, the students learn a trade. So they become carpenters or electricians or plumbers. And so we combine both those things, head and hands, trying to cultivate a fruitful, flourishing laity. The vocation of the laity.
Praise
That's the mission.
God. It's what we need. Check it out, the College of St. Joseph the Worker. Dr. Andrew Willard-Jones, I'm extremely grateful that you took the hour. I feel like I could do another hour with you just on friendship. I think your writing about friendship is fantastic. And I do think that Christ having called all of us his friends is relevant to our political theory, that
Absolutely.
We involve God, or God involves himself in friendship with us. And when we forget that, we get completely off track. But in any case, I thank you so much. I hope people will get The Church Against the State, the new book from Andrew Willard Jones. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.